As graduate schools continued to grind out bright young financial economists, the attacking academics became so numerous that it seemed obvious that a new strategy was needed. Ergo, the academic community busily went about erecting its own theories of stock market valuation. That's what this part of the book is all about. The rarefied world of the new investment technology created within the towers of the academy. One insight, modern portfolio theory, MPT, is so basic that it is now widely followed on the street. The others remain controversial enough to continue to generate thesis material for students and hefty lecture fees for their advisors. This chapter is about modern portfolio theory, whose insights will enable you to reduce risk while possibly earning a higher return. In Chapter 9, I turn to the academics who have suggested that investors can increase their returns by assuming a certain kind of risk. Then, in Chapters 10 and 11, I cover the arguments of some academics and practitioners who conclude that psychology, not rationality, rules the market and that there is no such thing as a random walk. They argue that markets are not efficient, that market prices are predictable, and that a number of investment strategies can be followed to beat the market. These include a number of smart beta strategies that have become popular on Wall Street. Then, I conclude by showing that, despite all the critics, traditional index funds remain the undisputed champions in taking the most profitable stroll through the market. The role of risk. The efficient market hypothesis explains why the random walk is possible. It holds that the stock market is so good at adjusting to new information that no one can predict its future course in a superior manner. Because of the actions of the pros, the prices of individual stocks quickly reflect all the news that is available. Thus, the odds of selecting superior stocks or anticipating the general direction of the market are even. Your guess is as good as that of the ape, your stockbroker, or even mine. I smell a rat, as Samuel Butler wrote long ago. Money is being made in the market. Some stocks do outperform others. Common sense attests that some people can and do beat the market. It's not all chance. Many academics agree, but the method of beating the market, they say, is not to exercise superior clairvoyance, but rather to assume greater risk. Risk and risk alone determines the degree to which returns will be above or below average. Defining risk. The dispersion of returns. Risk is a most slippery and elusive concept. It's hard for investors, let alone economists, to agree on a precise definition. The American Heritage Dictionary defines risk as the possibility of suffering harm or loss. If I am able to buy one-year treasury bills to yield 2% and hold them until they mature, I am virtually certain of earning a 2% monetary return before income taxes. The possibility of loss is so small as to be considered non-existent. If I hold common stock in my local electric utility for 1 year, anticipating a 5% dividend return, the possibility of loss is greater. The dividend of the company may be cut and, more important, the market price at the end of the year may be much lower, causing me to suffer a net loss. Investment risk, then, is the chance that expected security returns will not materialize and, in particular, that the securities you hold will fall in price. Once academics accepted the idea that risk for investors is related to the chance of disappointment in achieving expected security returns, a natural measure suggested itself, the probable dispersion of future returns. Thus, financial risk has generally been defined as the variance or standard deviation of returns. A security whose returns are not likely to depart much, if at all, from its average or expected return is said to carry little or no risk. A security whose returns from year to year are likely to be quite volatile and for which sharp losses occur in some years is said to be risky. It is, of course, quite true that only the possibility of downward disappointments constitutes risk. Nevertheless, as a practical matter, as long as the distribution of returns is symmetric, That is, as long as the chances of extraordinary gain are roughly the same as the probabilities for disappointing returns and losses, a dispersion or variance measure will suffice as a risk measure. The greater the dispersion or variance, the greater the possibilities for disappointment. Although the pattern of historical returns from individual securities has not usually been symmetric, the returns from well-diversified portfolios of stocks are at least roughly symmetric. If we look at the distribution of monthly security returns for a portfolio invested in the S&P 500 stock index over 70 years, we see that on average, the portfolio returned close to 1% per month, or about 11% per year. In periods when the market declined sharply, however, the portfolio also plunged, losing more than 20% in a single month. For reasonably symmetric distributions such as this one, a helpful rule of thumb is that two-thirds of the monthly returns tend to fall within one standard deviation of the average return, and 95% of the returns fall within two standard deviations. Recall that the average return for this distribution was close to 1% per month. The standard deviation, our measure of portfolio risk, turns out to be about 4.5% per month. Thus, in two-thirds of the months, the returns from this portfolio were between plus 5.5% and minus 3.5%, and 95% of the returns were between 10% and minus 8%. Obviously, the higher the standard deviation, the more spread out the returns, the more probable it is, the greater the risk, that at least in some periods you will take a real bath in the market. That's why a measure of variability, such as standard deviation, is so often used and justified as an indication of risk. Documenting risk, a long-run study. One of the best documented propositions in the field of finance is that, on average, investors have received higher rates of return for bearing greater risk. The most thorough study has been done by Ibbotson Associates. Its data cover the period 1926 through 2013. It shows that over long periods of time, common stocks have, on average, provided relatively generous total rates of return. These returns, including dividends and capital gains, have exceeded by a substantial margin the returns from long-term bonds, treasury bills, and the inflation rate as measured by the annual rate of increase in consumer prices. Thus, stocks have tended to provide positive, real rates of return, that is, returns after washing out the effects of inflation. The data show, however, that common stock returns are highly variable. Returns from equities have ranged from a gain of more than 50% in 1933 to a loss of almost the same percentage in 1931. Clearly, the extra returns that have been available to investors from stocks have come at the expense of assuming considerably higher risk. Note that small company stocks have provided an even higher rate of return since 1926, but the dispersion, standard deviation, of those returns has been even larger than for equities in general. Again, we see that higher returns have been associated with higher risks. There have been several periods of 5 years or longer when common stocks have produced negative rates of return. The period 1930 to 32 was extremely poor for stock market investors. The early 1970s also produced negative returns. The one-third decline in the broad stock market averages during October 1987 is the most dramatic change in stock prices during a brief period since the 1930s. And stock investors know only too well how poorly stocks performed during the first decade of the 2000s. Still, over the long haul, investors have been rewarded with higher returns for taking on more risk. However, there are ways in which investors can reduce risk. This brings us to the subject of modern portfolio theory, which has revolutionized the investment thinking of professionals. Reducing risk. Modern portfolio theory, MPT. Portfolio theory begins with the premise that all investors are like my wife. They are risk-averse. They want high returns and guaranteed outcomes. The theory tells investors how to combine stocks in their portfolios to give them the least risk possible, consistent with the return they seek. It also gives a rigorous mathematical justification for the time-honored investment maxim that diversification is a sensible strategy for individuals who like to reduce their risks. The theory was invented in the 1950s by Harry Markowitz, and for his contribution he was awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics in 1990. His book, Portfolio Selection, was an outgrowth of his Ph.D. dissertation at the University of Chicago. His experience has ranged from teaching at UCLA to designing a computer language at Rand Corporation. He even ran a hedge fund, serving as president of Arbitrage Management Company. What Markowitz discovered was that portfolios of risky, volatile stocks might be put together in such a way that the portfolio as a whole could be less risky than the individual stocks in it. The mathematics of modern portfolio theory, also known as MPT, is recondite and forbidding. It fills the journals and, incidentally, keeps a lot of academics busy. That in itself is no small accomplishment. Fortunately, there is no need to lead you through the labyrinth of quadratic programming for you to understand the core of the theory. A single illustration will make the whole game clear. Let's suppose we have an island economy with only two businesses. The first is a large resort with beaches, tennis courts, and a golf course. The second is a manufacturer of umbrellas. Weather affects the fortunes of both. During sunny seasons, the resort does a booming business and umbrella sales plummet. During rainy seasons, the resort owner does very poorly while the umbrella manufacturer enjoys high sales and profits. Suppose that, on average, one half of the seasons are sunny and one half are rainy. That is, the probability of a sunny or rainy season is one half. An investor who bought stock in the umbrella manufacturer would find that half the time he earned a 50% return and half the time he lost 25% of his investment. On average, he would earn a return of 12.5%. This is what we have called the investor's expected return. Similarly, investment in the resort would produce the same results. Investing in either one of these businesses would be fairly risky, however, because the results are quite variable and there could be several sunny or rainy seasons in a row. Suppose, however, that instead of buying only one security, an investor with $2 diversified and put half his money in the umbrella manufacturer's and half in the resort owner's business. In sunny seasons, a $1 investment in the resort would produce a 50-cent return, whereas a $1 investment in the umbrella manufacturer would lose 25 cents. The investor's total return would be 25 cents, 50 cents minus 25 cents, which is 12.5% of his total investment of $2. Note that during rainy seasons, exactly the same thing happens, only the names are changed. Investment in the umbrella manufacturer produces a 50% return, while the investment in the resort loses 25%. Again, the diversified investor makes a 12.5% return on his total investment. This simple illustration points out the basic advantage of diversification. Whatever happens to the weather, and thus to the island economy, by diversifying investments over both of the firms, an investor is sure of making a 12.5% return each year. The trick that made the game work was that although both companies were risky, returns were variable from year to year, the companies were affected differently by weather conditions. As long as there is some lack of parallelism in the fortunes of the individual companies in the economy, diversification can reduce risk. In the present case, where there is a perfect negative relationship between the company's fortunes, one always does well when the other does poorly, diversification can totally eliminate risk. Of course, there's always a rub, and in this case, it's that the fortunes of most companies move pretty much in tandem. When there is a recession and people are unemployed, they may buy neither summer vacations nor umbrellas. Therefore, one shouldn't expect in practice to get the neat kind of total risk elimination just shown. Nevertheless, because company fortunes don't always move completely in parallel, investment in a diversified portfolio of stocks is likely to be less risky than investment in one or two single securities. It is easy to carry the lessons of this illustration to actual portfolio construction. Suppose you were considering combining Ford Motor Company and its major supplier of new tires in a stock portfolio. Would diversification be likely to give you much risk reduction? Probably not. If Ford's sales slump, Ford will be buying fewer new tires from the tire manufacturer. In general, diversification will not help much if there is a high covariance, high correlation, between the returns of the two companies. On the other hand, if Ford was combined with a government contractor in a depressed area, diversification might reduce risk substantially. If consumer spending is down, or if oil prices skyrocket, Ford's sales and earnings are likely to be down and the nation's level of unemployment up. If the government makes a habit during times of high unemployment of giving out contracts to the depressed area to alleviate some of the unemployment miseries there, it could well be that the returns of Ford and those of the contractor do not move in phase. The two stocks might have very little covariance, or, better still, negative covariance. The example may seem a bit strained, and most investors will realize that when the market gets clobbered, just about all stocks go down. Still, at least at certain times, some stocks and some classes of assets do move against the market. That is, they have negative covariance, or, and this is the same thing, they are negatively correlated with each other. Now comes the real kicker. Negative correlation is not necessary to achieve the risk reduction benefits from diversification. Markowitz's great contribution to investors' wallets was his demonstration that anything less than perfect positive correlation can potentially reduce risk. It demonstrates the crucial role of the correlation coefficient in determining whether adding a security or an asset class can reduce risk. Diversification in practice. To paraphrase Shakespeare, can there be too much of a good thing? In other words, is there a point at which diversification is no longer a magic wand safeguarding returns? Numerous studies have demonstrated that the answer is yes. The golden number for American xenophobes, those fearful of looking beyond our national borders, is at least 50 equal-sized and well-diversified U.S. stocks. Clearly, 50 oil stocks or 50 electric utilities would not produce an equivalent amount of risk reduction. With such a portfolio, the total risk is reduced by over 60%, and that's where the good news stops, as further increases in the number of holdings do not produce much additional risk reduction. Those with a broader view, investors who recognize that the world has changed considerably since Markowitz first enunciated his theory, can reap even greater protection because the movement of foreign economies is not always synchronous with that of the U.S. economy, especially those in emerging markets. For example, increases in the price of oil and raw materials have a negative effect on Europe, Japan, and even the United States, which is at least partially self-sufficient. On the other hand, oil price increases have a very positive effect on Indonesia and oil-producing countries in the Middle East. Similarly, increases in mineral and other raw material prices have positive effects on nations rich in natural resources, such as Australia and Brazil. It turns out that about 50 is also the golden number for global-minded investors. Such investors, however, get more protection for their money. Here, the stocks are drawn not simply from the U.S. stock market, but from the international markets as well. As expected, the international diversified portfolio tends to be less risky than the one drawn purely from U.S. stocks. The benefits of international diversification have been well documented. Over the more than 40-year period from 1970 through 2013, foreign stocks, as measured by the Morgan Stanley EAFE, Europe, Australasia, and Far East Index of Developed Foreign Countries, had an average annual return that was slightly higher than the U.S. stocks in the S&P 500 index. U.S. stocks, however, were safer in that their year-to-year returns were less volatile. The correlation between the returns from the two indexes during this time period was around 0.5, positive, but only moderately high. As the portfolio shifts from a 100% domestic allocation to one with gradual additions of foreign stocks, the return tends to increase because EAFE stocks produce a slightly higher return than domestic stocks over this period. The significant point, however, is that adding some of these riskier securities actually reduces the portfolio's risk level, at least for a while. Eventually, however, As larger and larger proportions of the riskier EAFE stocks are put into the portfolio, the overall risk rises with the overall return. The paradoxical result of this analysis is that overall portfolio risk is reduced by the addition of a small amount of riskier foreign securities. Good returns from Japanese automakers balanced out poor returns from domestic ones when the Japanese share of the U.S. market increased. On the other hand, good returns from U.S. manufacturers offset poor returns from foreign manufacturers when the dollar became more competitive and Japan and Europe remained in a recession as the U.S. economy boomed. It is precisely these offsetting movements that reduced the overall volatility of the portfolio. It turns out that the portfolio with the least risk had 17% foreign securities and 83% U.S. securities. Moreover, adding 17% EAFE stocks to a domestic portfolio also tended to increase the portfolio return. International diversification provided the closest thing to a free lunch available in our world securities markets. When higher returns can be achieved with lower risk by adding international stocks, no investor should fail to take notice. Some portfolio managers have argued that diversification has not continued to give the same degree of benefit as was previously the case. Globalization led to an increase in the correlation coefficients between the U.S. and foreign markets as well as between stocks and commodities. Correlation coefficients have risen over the first decade of the 2000s. Particularly upsetting for investors is that correlations have been high when markets have been falling. During the global credit crisis of 2007 to 2009, all markets fell in unison. There was apparently no place to hide. Small wonder that some investors came to believe that diversification no longer seemed to be as effective a strategy to decrease risk. Even though correlations between markets have risen, they are still far from perfectly correlated, and broad diversification will still tend to reduce the volatility of a portfolio. And even over periods when different equity markets tended to zig and zag together, diversification still provided substantial benefits. Consider the first decade of the 21st century, which was widely referred to as a lost decade for U.S. equity investors. Markets in developed countries, the United States, Europe, and Japan, ended the decade at or below their levels at the start of the decade. Investors who limited their portfolios to stocks in developed economies failed to earn satisfactory returns. But over that same decade, investors who included equities from emerging markets, which were easily available through low-cost, broadly diversified emerging market equity index funds, enjoyed quite satisfactory equity investment performance. An investment in the S&P 500 did not make any money during the first decade of the 2000s. But investment in a broad emerging market index produced quite satisfactory returns. Broad international diversification would have been of enormous benefit to U.S. investors even during the lost decade. Moreover, safe bonds proved their worth as a risk reducer. Correlation coefficients between U.S. Treasury bonds and large capitalization U.S. equities fell during the 2008 to 2009 financial crisis. Even during the horrible stock market of 2008, a broadly diversified portfolio of bonds invested in the Barclays Capital Broad Bond Index returned 5.2%. There was a place to hide during the financial crisis. Bonds and bond-like securities to be covered in Part 4 have proved their worth as an effective diversifier. In summary, the timeless lessons of diversification are as powerful today as they were in the past. In Part 4, I will rely on this discussion of portfolio theory to craft appropriate asset allocations for individuals in different age brackets and with different risk tolerances. Chapter 9. Reaping Reward by Increasing Risk. From George J. Stigler, The Theory of Price. Theories that are right only 50% of the time are less economical than coin flipping. As every reader should know by now, risk has its rewards. Thus, both within academia and on the street, there has long been a scramble to exploit risk to earn greater returns. That's what this chapter covers. The creation of analytical tools to measure risk and with such knowledge reap greater rewards. We begin with a refinement to modern portfolio theory. As I mentioned in the last chapter, diversification cannot eliminate all risk, as it did in my mythical island economy, because all stocks tend to move up and down together. Thus, diversification in practice reduces some but not all risk. Three academics, the former Stanford professor William Sharp and the late finance specialists John Lintner and Fisher Black, focused their intellectual energies on determining what part of a security's risk can be eliminated by diversification and what part cannot. The result is known as the capital asset pricing model. Sharp received a Nobel Prize for his contribution to this work at the same time Markowitz was honored in 1990. The basic logic behind the capital asset pricing model is that there is no premium for bearing risks that can be diversified away. Thus, to get a higher average long-run rate of return, you need to increase the risk level of the portfolio that cannot be diversified away. According to this theory, savvy investors can outperform the overall market by adjusting their portfolios with a risk measure known as beta. Beta and systematic risk. Beta? How did a Greek letter enter this discussion? Surely it didn't originate with a stockbroker. Can you imagine any stockbroker saying, "We can reasonably describe the total risk of any security or portfolio as the total variability, variance or standard deviation, of the returns from the security"? But we who teach say such things often. We go on to say that part of total risk or variability may be called the security's systematic risk, and that this arises from the basic variability of stock prices in general and the tendency for all stocks to go along with the general market, at least to some extent. The remaining variability in a stock's returns is called unsystematic risk and results from factors peculiar to that particular company, for example, a strike, the discovery of a new product, and so on. Systematic risk, also called market risk, captures the reaction of individual stocks or portfolios to general market swings. Some stocks and portfolios tend to be very sensitive to market movements. Others are more stable. This relative volatility or sensitivity to market moves can be estimated on the basis of the past record and is popularly known by, you guess it, the Greek letter beta. You are now about to learn all you ever wanted to know about beta but were afraid to ask. Basically, beta is the numerical description of systematic risk. Despite the mathematical manipulations involved, the basic idea behind the beta measurement is one of putting some precise numbers on the subjective feelings money managers have had for years. The beta calculation is essentially a comparison between the movements of an individual stock or portfolio and the movements of the market as a whole. The calculation begins by assigning a beta of 1 to a broad market index. If a stock has a beta of 2, then, on average, it swings twice as far as the market. If the market goes up 10%, the stock tends to rise 20%. If a stock has a beta of 0.5, it tends to go up or down 5% when the market rises or declines 10%. Professionals call high beta stocks aggressive investments and label low beta stocks as defensive. Now the important thing to realize is that systematic risk cannot be eliminated by diversification. It is precisely because all stocks move more or less in tandem, a large share of their variability is systematic, that even diversified stock portfolios are risky. Indeed, if you diversified perfectly by buying a share in the total stock market index, which by definition has a beta of 1, you would still have quite variable, risky returns because the market as a whole fluctuates wildly. Unsystematic risk is the variability in stock prices, and therefore in returns from stocks, that results from factors peculiar to an individual company. Receipt of a large new contract, the finding of mineral resources, labor difficulties, accounting fraud, the discovery that the corporation's treasurer has had his hand in the company till, all can make a stock's price move independently of the market. The risk associated with such variability is precisely the kind that diversification can reduce. The whole point of portfolio theory is that to the extent that stocks don't always move in tandem, variations in the returns from any one security tend to be washed away by complementary variation in the returns from others. Suppose we randomly select securities for our portfolio that on average are just as volatile as the market. The average betas for the securities in our portfolio will be equal to 1. As we add more securities, the total risk of our portfolio declines, especially at the start. When 30 securities are selected for our portfolio, a good deal of the unsystematic risk is eliminated, and additional diversification yields little further risk reduction. By the time 60 well-diversified securities are in the portfolio, the unsystematic risk is substantially eliminated, and our portfolio, with a beta of 1, will tend to move up and down essentially in tandem with the market. Of course, we could perform the same experiment with stocks whose average beta is 1.5. Again, we would find that diversification quickly reduced unsystematic risk, but the remaining systematic risk would be larger. A portfolio of 60 or more stocks with an average beta of 1.5 would tend to be 50% more volatile than the market. Now comes the key step in the argument. Financial theorists and practitioners agree that investors should be compensated for taking on more risk with a higher expected return. Stock prices must therefore adjust to offer higher returns where more risk is perceived to ensure that all securities are held by someone. Obviously, risk-averse investors wouldn't buy securities with extra risk without the expectation of extra reward. But not all of the risk for individual securities is relevant in determining the premium for bearing risk. The unsystematic part of the total risk is easily eliminated by adequate diversification, so there is no reason to think that investors will receive extra compensation for bearing unsystematic risk. The only part of total risk that investors will get paid for bearing is systematic risk, the risk that diversification cannot help. Thus, the capital asset pricing model says that returns, and therefore risk premiums, for any stock or portfolio will be related to beta, the systematic risk that cannot be diversified away. The Capital Asset Pricing Model, CAPM. The proposition that risk and reward are related is not new. Finance specialists have agreed for years that investors do need to be compensated for taking on more risk. What is different about the new investment technology is the definition and measurement of risk. Before the advent of the capital asset pricing model, it was believed that the return on each security was related to the total risk inherent in that security. It was believed that the return from a security varied with the variability or standard deviation of the returns it produced. The new theory says that the total risk of each individual security is irrelevant. It is only the systematic component that counts as far as extra rewards go. Although the mathematical proof of this proposition is forbidding, the logic behind it is fairly simple. Consider two groups of securities, Group 1 and Group 2, with 60 securities in each. Suppose that the systematic risk, beta, for each security is 1. That is, each of the securities in the two groups tends to move up and down in tandem with the general market. Now suppose that, because of factors peculiar to the individual securities in Group 1, the total risk for each of them is substantially higher than the total risk for each security in Group 2. Imagine, for example, that in addition to general market factors, the securities in Group 1 are also particularly susceptible to climatic variations, to changes in exchange rates, and to natural disasters. The specific risk for each of the securities in Group 1 will therefore be very high. The specific risk for each of the securities in Group 2, however, is assumed to be very low, and hence the total risk for each of them will be very low. Now, according to the old theory, commonly accepted before the advent of the capital asset pricing model, returns should be higher for a portfolio made up of Group 1 securities because each security in Group 1 has a higher total risk than each security in Group 2, and risk, as we know, has its reward. With a wave of their intellectual wands, the academics changed that sort of thinking. Under the capital asset pricing model, returns from the two portfolios should be equal. Why? The old and new views now meet head-on. Under the old system of valuation, Group 1 securities were regarded as offering a higher return because of their greater risk. The capital asset pricing model says there is no greater risk in holding Group 1 securities if they are in a diversified portfolio. Indeed, if the securities of Group 1 did offer higher returns, then all rational investors would prefer them over Group 2 securities and would attempt to rearrange their holdings to capture the higher returns from Group 1. But by this very process, they would bid up the prices of Group 1 securities and push down the prices of Group 2 securities until, with the attainment of equilibrium, would investors no longer want to switch from security to security, the portfolios for each group had identical returns, related to the systematic component of the risk, beta, rather than to their total risk, including the unsystematic or specific portions. Because stocks can be combined in portfolios to eliminate specific risk, only the undiversifiable or systematic risk will command a risk premium. Investors will not get paid for bearing risks that can be diversified away. This is the basic logic behind the capital asset pricing model. In a big fat nutshell, the proof of the capital asset pricing model, henceforth to be known as CAPM because we economists love to use letter abbreviations, can be stated as follows. If investors did get an extra return, a risk premium, for bearing unsystematic risk, it would turn out that diversified portfolios made up of stocks with large amounts of unsystematic risk would give larger returns than equally risky portfolios of stocks with less unsystematic risk. Investors would snap at the chance to have these higher returns, bidding up the prices of stocks with large unsystematic risk and selling stocks with equivalent betas but lower unsystematic risk. This process would continue until the prospective returns of stocks with the same betas were equalized and no risk premium could be obtained for bearing unsystematic risk. Any other result would be inconsistent with the existence of an efficient market. As the systematic risk beta of an individual stock or portfolio increases, so does the return an investor can expect. If an investor's portfolio has a beta of zero, as might be the case if all her funds were invested in a government-guaranteed bank savings certificate, beta would be zero because the returns from the certificate would not vary at all with swings in the stock market, the investor would receive some modest rate of return, which is generally called the risk-free rate of interest. As the individual takes on more risk, however, the return should increase. If the investor holds a portfolio with a beta of 1, as for example holding a share in a broad stock market index fund, her return will equal the general return from common stocks. This return has over long periods of time exceeded the risk-free rate of interest, but the investment is a risky one. In certain periods, the return is much less than the risk-free rate and involves taking substantial losses. This is precisely what is meant by risk. A number of different expected returns are possible simply by adjusting the beta of the portfolio. For example, suppose the investor put half of her money in a savings certificate and half in a share of an index fund representing the broad stock market. In this case, she would receive a return midway between the risk-free return and the return from the market, and her portfolio would have an average beta of 0.5. The CAPM then asserts that to get a higher average long-run rate of return, you should just increase the beta of your portfolio. An investor can get a portfolio with a beta larger than 1 either by buying high-beta stocks or by purchasing a portfolio with average volatility on margin. Just as stocks had their fads, so beta came into high fashion in the early 1970s. Institutional Investor, the prestigious magazine that spent most of its pages chronicling the accomplishments of professional money managers, put its imprimatur on the movement by featuring on its cover the letter beta on top of a temple and including it as its lead story, the beta cult, the new way to measure risk. The magazine noted that money men, whose mathematics hardly went beyond long division, were now tossing betas around with the abandon of PhDs in statistical theory. Even the SEC gave beta its approval as a risk measure in its Institutional Investors study report. On Wall Street, the early beta fans boasted that they could earn higher long-run rates of return simply by buying a few high-beta stocks. Those who thought they were able to time the market, thought they had an even better idea. They would buy high beta stocks when they thought the market was going up, switching to low beta ones when they feared the market might decline. To accommodate the enthusiasm for this new investment idea, beta measurement services proliferated among brokers, and it was a symbol of progressiveness for an investment house to provide its own beta estimates. Today, you can obtain beta estimates from brokers such as Merrill Lynch and investment advisory services such as ValueLine and Morningstar. The beta boosters on the street oversold their product with an abandon that would have shocked even the most enthusiastic academic scribblers intent on spreading the beta gospel. Let's look at the record. In Shakespeare's Henry IV, Part 1, Glendower boasts to Hotspur, "I can call spirits from the vasty deep." "Why, so can I, or so can any man," says Hotspur, unimpressed. "But will they come when you do call for them?" Anyone can theorize about how security markets work. CAPM is just another theory. The really important question is, does it work? Certainly many institutional investors have embraced the beta concept. Beta is, after all, an academic creation. What could be more staid? Simply created as a number that describes a stock's risk, it appears almost sterile in nature. The closet chartists love it. Even if you don't believe in beta, you have to speak its language because back on the nation's campuses, my colleagues and I have been producing a long line of PhDs and MBAs who spout its terminology. They now use beta as a method of evaluating a portfolio manager's performance. If the realized return is larger than that predicted by the portfolio beta, the manager is said to have produced a positive alpha. Lots of money in the market sought out managers who could deliver the largest alpha. But is beta a useful measure of risk? Is it true that high beta portfolios will provide larger long-term returns than lower beta ones, as the capital asset pricing model suggests? Does beta alone summarize a security's total systematic risk, or do we need to consider other factors as well? In short, does beta really deserve an alpha? These are subjects of intense current debate among practitioners and academics. In a study published in 1992, Eugene Fama and Kenneth French divided all traded stocks into deciles according to their beta measures over the 1963 to 1990 period. Decile 1 contained the 10% of all stocks that had the lowest betas. Decile 10 contained the 10% that had the highest betas. The remarkable result is that there was essentially no relationship between the return of these decile portfolios and their beta measures. I found a similar result for the relationship between return and beta for mutual funds. There was no relationship between returns for stocks or portfolios and their beta risk measures. Because their comprehensive study covered a period of almost 30 years, Fama and French concluded that the relationship between beta and return is essentially flat. Beta, the key analytical tool of the capital asset pricing model, is not a useful single measure to capture the relationship between risk and return. And so, by the mid-1990s, not only practitioners but even many academics as well were ready to assign beta to the scrap heap. The financial press, which earlier had chronicled the ascendancy of beta, now ran feature stories with titles such as "The Death of Beta," "Bye-Bye Beta," and "Beta Beaten." Typical of the times was a letter quoted in Institutional Investor from a writer known only as Deep Quant. Quant is the Wall Street nickname for the quantitatively inclined financial analyst who devotes attention largely to the new investment technology. The letter began, "There is a very big story breaking in money management. The capital asset pricing model is dead." The magazine went on to quote one turncoat quant as follows: "Advanced mathematics will become to investors what the Titanic was to sailing." And so the whole set of tools making up the new investment technology, including even modern portfolio theory, came under a cloud of suspicion. An appraisal of the evidence. My own guess is that the turncoat quant is wrong. The unearthing of serious cracks in the CAPM will not lead to an abandonment of mathematical tools in financial analysis and a return to traditional security analysis. The financial community is not ready to write an obituary for Beta at this time. There are many reasons, I believe, to avoid a rush to judgment. First, it is important to remember that stable returns are preferable, that is, less risky than very volatile returns. Clearly, if one could earn only the same return drilling for oil as from a riskless government security, only those who loved gambling for gambling's sake alone would drill for oil. If investors really did not worry at all about volatility, the multi-trillion-dollar derivative securities markets would not be thriving as they are. Thus, the beta measure of relative volatility does capture at least some aspects of what we normally think of as risk. And portfolio betas from the past do a reasonably good job of predicting relative volatility in the future. Second, as Professor Richard Roll of UCLA has argued, we must keep in mind that it is very difficult, indeed probably impossible, to measure beta with any degree of precision. The S&P 500 index is not the market. The total stock market contains many thousands of additional stocks in the United States and thousands more in foreign countries. Moreover, the total market includes bonds, real estate, commodities, and assets of all sorts, including one of the most important assets any of us has, the human capital built up by education, work, and life experiences. Depending on exactly how you measure the market, you can obtain very different beta values. One's conclusions about the capital asset pricing model and beta as a measure of risk depend very much on how you measure beta. Two economists from the University of Minnesota, Ravi Jagannathan and Zhenyu Wang, find that when the market index against which we measure beta is redefined to include human capital, and when betas are allowed to vary with cyclical fluctuations in the economy, the support for the CAPM and beta as a predictor of returns is quite strong. Finally, investors should be aware that even if the long-run relationship between beta and return is flat, beta can still be a useful investment management tool. Were it in fact the case that low beta stocks will dependably earn rates of return at least as large as those of high beta stocks, a very big if indeed, then beta would be even more valuable as an investment tool than if the capital asset pricing model held. Investors should scoop up low beta stocks and earn returns as attractive as for the market as a whole, but with much less risk. And investors who do wish to seek higher returns by assuming greater risk should buy and hold low beta stocks on margin, thereby increasing their risk and returns. We shall see in Chapter 11 that some smart beta strategies are designed to execute that exact strategy. What is clear, however, is that beta, as usually measured, is not a substitute for brains and cannot be relied on as a simple predictor of long-run future returns. The quant quest for better measures of risk. Arbitrage pricing theory. If beta is damaged as an effective quantitative measure of risk, is there anything to take its place? One of the pioneers in the field of risk measurement is Stephen Ross. Ross has developed a theory of pricing in the capital markets called arbitrage pricing theory, APT. To understand the logic of APT, one must remember the correct insight underlying the CAPM. The only risk that investors should be compensated for bearing is the risk that cannot be diversified away. Only systematic risk will command a risk premium. But the systematic elements of risk in particular stocks and portfolios may be too complicated to be captured by beta, the tendency of the stocks to move more or less than the market. This is especially so because any particular stock index is an imperfect representative of the general market. Hence, beta may fail to capture a number of important systematic elements of risk. Let's take a look at several of these other systematic risk elements. Changes in national income undoubtedly affect returns from individual stocks in a systematic way. This was shown in our illustration of a simple island economy in Chapter 8. Also, changes in national income mirror changes in the personal income of individuals, and the systematic relationship between security returns and salary income can be expected to have a significant effect on individual behavior. For example, the laborer in a Ford plant will find that holding Ford common stock is particularly risky because job layoffs and poor returns from Ford stock are likely to occur at the same time. Changes in national income may also reflect changes in other forms of property income and may therefore be relevant for institutional portfolio managers as well. Changes in interest rates also systematically affect the returns from individual stocks and are important non-diversifiable risk elements. To the extent that stocks tend to suffer as interest rates go up, equities are a risky investment, and those stocks that are particularly vulnerable to increases in the general level of interest rates are especially risky. Thus, some stocks and fixed income investments tend to move in parallel, and these stocks will not be helpful in reducing the risk of a bond portfolio. Because fixed income securities are a major part of the portfolios of many institutional investors, this systematic risk factor is particularly important for some of the largest investors in the market. Changes in the rate of inflation will similarly tend to have a systematic influence on the returns from common stocks. This is so for at least two reasons. First, an increase in the rate of inflation tends to increase interest rates and thus tends to lower the prices of some equities, as just discussed. Second, the increase in inflation may squeeze profit margins for certain groups of companies, public utilities, for example, which often find that rate increases lag behind increases in costs. On the other hand, inflation may benefit the prices of common stocks in the natural resource industries. Thus, again, there are important systematic relationships between stock returns and economic variables that may not be captured adequately by a simple beta measure of risk. Statistical tests of the influence on security returns of several systematic risk variables have shown somewhat promising results. Better explanations than those given by the CAPM can be obtained for the variation in returns among different securities by using, in addition to the traditional beta measure of risk, a number of systematic risk variables, such as sensitivity to changes in national income, in interest rates, and in the rate of inflation. Of course, the APT measures of risk are beset by some of the same problems faced by the CAPM beta measure. The Fama-French three-factor model. Eugene Fama and Kenneth French have proposed a factor model like arbitrage pricing theory to account for risk. Two factors are used in addition to beta to describe risk. The factors derive from their empirical work showing that returns are related to the size of the company as measured by the market capitalization and to the relationship of its market price to its book value. Fama French argue that smaller firms are relatively risky. One explanation might be that they will have more difficulty sustaining themselves during recessionary periods and thus may have more systematic risk relative to fluctuations in GDP. Fama French also argue that stocks with low market prices relative to their book values may be in some degree of financial distress. These views are hotly debated, and not everyone agrees that the Fama French factors measure risk. But certainly, regarding early 2009, when the stocks of major banks sold at very low prices relative to their book values, it is hard to argue that investors did not consider them in danger of going bankrupt. And even those who would argue that low market to book value stocks provide higher returns because of investor irrationality find the Fama French risk factors useful. The Fama French risk factors. Beta, from the capital asset pricing model. Size, measured by total equity market capitalization. Value, measured by the ratio of market to book value. Some analysts would add further variables to the Fama French three-factor risk model. A momentum factor could be added to capture the tendency for rising or falling stocks to continue moving in the same direction. In addition, a liquidity factor could be added to reflect the fact that investors need to be paid a return premium to induce them to hold illiquid securities. A further factor that has been suggested is the quality of the company as measured by such indicators as the stability of its earnings and sales growth and its low amount of debt. Factor models are extensively used now to measure investment performance and to design smart beta portfolios, as will be discussed in Chapter 11. A summing up. Chapters 8 and 9 have been an academic exercise in the modern theory of capital markets. The stock market appears to be an efficient mechanism that adjusts quite quickly to new information. Neither technical analysis, which analyzes the past price movements of stocks, nor fundamental analysis, which analyzes more basic information about the prospects for individual companies and the economy, seems to yield consistent benefits. It appears that the only way to obtain higher long-run investment returns is to accept greater risks. Unfortunately, a perfect risk measure does not exist. Beta, the risk measure from the capital asset pricing model, looks nice on the surface. It is a simple, easy-to-understand measure of market sensitivity. Alas, beta also has its warts. The actual relationship between beta and rate of return has not corresponded to the relationship predicted in theory during long periods of the 20th century. Moreover, betas for individual stocks are not stable over time, and they are very sensitive to the market proxy against which they are measured. I have argued here that no single measure is likely to capture adequately the variety of systematic risk influences on individual stocks and portfolios. Returns are probably sensitive to general market swings, to changes in interest and inflation rates, to changes in national income, and undoubtedly to other economic factors such as exchange rates. Moreover, there is evidence that returns are higher for stocks with lower price-book ratios and smaller size. The mystical perfect risk measure is still beyond our grasp. To the great relief of assistant professors who must publish or perish, there is still much debate within the academic community on risk measurement, and much more empirical testing needs to be done. Undoubtedly, there will yet be many improvements in the techniques of risk analysis, and the quantitative analysis of risk measurement is far from dead. My own guess is that future risk measures will be even more sophisticated, not less so. Nevertheless, we must be careful not to accept beta or any other measure as an easy way to assess risk and to predict future returns with any certainty. You should know about the best of the modern techniques of the new investment technology. They can be useful aids, but there is never going to be a handsome genie who will appear and solve all our investment problems. And even if he did, we would probably foul it up, as did the little old lady in the following favorite story of Robert Kirby of Capital Guardian Trust. She was sitting in her rocking chair on the porch of the retirement home when a little genie appeared and said, "I've decided to grant you 3 wishes." The little old lady answered, "Buzz off, you little twerp. I've seen all the wise guys I need to in my life." The genie answered, "Look, I'm not kidding. This is for real. Just try me." She shrugged and said, "Okay, turn my rocking chair into solid gold." When, in a puff of smoke, he did it, her interest picked up noticeably. She said, "Turn me into a beautiful young maiden." Again, in a puff of smoke, he did it. Finally, she said, "Okay, my 3rd wish, turn my cat into a handsome young prince." In an instant, there stood the young prince, who then turned to her and asked, "Now, aren't you sorry you had me fixed?" Chapter 10. Behavioral Finance. From Meyer Stottman. Behavioral finance is not a branch of standard finance. It is its replacement with a better model of humanity. Thus far, I have described stock market theories and techniques based on the premise that investors are completely rational. They make decisions with the objective of maximizing their wealth and are constrained only by their tolerance for bearing risk. Not so, declares a new school of financial economists who came to prominence in the early part of the 21st century. Behavioralists believe that many, perhaps even most, stock market investors are far from fully rational. After all, think of the behavior of your friends and acquaintances, your fellow workers and your supervisors, your parents and, dare I say, spouse. Children, of course, are another matter. Do any of these people act rationally? If your answer is no, or even sometimes no, you will enjoy this journey down the less-than-rational byways of behavioral finance. Efficient market theory, modern portfolio theory, and various asset pricing relationships between risk and return all are built on the premise that stock market investors are rational. As a whole, They make reasonable estimates of the present value of stocks, and their buying and selling ensures that the prices of stocks fairly represent their future prospects. By now, it should be obvious that the phrase, as a whole, represents the economist's escape hatch. That means they can admit that some individual market participants may be less than rational. But they quickly wriggle out by declaring that the trades of irrational investors will be random and therefore cancel each other out without affecting prices. And even if investors are irrational in a similar way, efficient market theory believers assert that smart, rational traders will correct any mispricings that might arise from the presence of irrational traders. Psychologists will have none of this economic claptrap. Two in particular, Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, blasted economists' views about how investors behave and in the process are credited with fathering a whole new economic discipline called behavioral finance. The two argued quite simply that people are not as rational as economic models assume. Although this argument is obvious to the general public and non-economists, it took over 20 years for it to become widely accepted in academia. Tversky died in 1996, just as it was gaining increased credibility. 6 years later, Kahneman won the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Sciences for the work. The award was particularly notable in that it was not given to an economist. Upon hearing the news, Kahneman commented, "The prize is quite explicitly for joint work, but unfortunately, there is no posthumous prize." Though the insights expounded by Kahneman and Tversky affected all social sciences dealing with the process of decision-making, they had a particularly strong impact on economics departments and business schools across the country. Imagine, a whole new field in which to publish papers, give lectures for hefty fees, and write graduate theses. While that may be all well and good for the professors and the students, what about all the other people who want to invest in stocks? How can behavioral finance help them? More to the point, what's in it for you? Actually, quite a bit. Behavioralists believe that market prices are highly imprecise. Moreover, people deviate in systematic ways from rationality, and the irrational trades of investors tend to be correlated. Behavioral finance then takes that statement further by asserting that it is possible to quantify or classify such irrational behavior. Basically, there are four factors that create irrational market behavior: overconfidence, biased judgments, herd mentality, and loss aversion. Well, yes, believers in efficient markets say, but, and we believers always have a but, the distortions caused by such factors are countered by the work of arbitrageurs. This last is the fancy word used to describe people who profit from any deviation of market prices from their rational value. In a strict sense, the word arbitrage means profiting from prices of the same good that differ in two markets. Suppose in New York you can buy or sell British pounds for $1.50, while in London you can trade dollars for pounds at a $2 exchange rate. The arbitrageur would then take $1.50 in New York and buy a pound and simultaneously sell it in London for $2, making a 50-cent profit. Similarly, if a common stock sold at different prices in New York and London, it would be justifiable to buy it in the cheap market and sell it in the expensive one. The term arbitrage is generally extended to situations where two very similar stocks sell at different valuations, or where one stock is expected to be exchanged for another stock at a higher price if a planned merger between the two companies is approved. In the loosest sense of the term, arbitrage is used to describe the buying of stocks that appear undervalued and the selling of those that have gotten too high. In so doing, hard-working arbitrageurs can smooth out irrational fluctuations in stock prices and create an efficiently priced market. On the other hand, behavioralists believe there are substantial barriers to efficient arbitrage. We cannot count on arbitrage to bring prices in line with rational valuation. Market prices can be expected to deviate substantially from those that could be expected in an efficient market. The remainder of this chapter explores the key arguments of behavioral finance in explaining why markets are not efficient and why there is no such thing as a random walk down Wall Street. I'll also explain how an understanding of this work can help protect individual investors from some systematic errors that investors are prone to. The irrational behavior of individual investors. As Part 1 made abundantly clear, there are always times when investors are irrational. Behavioral finance, however, says that this behavior is continual rather than episodic. Overconfidence. Researchers in cognitive psychology have documented that people deviate in systematic ways from rationality in making judgments amid uncertainty. One of the most pervasive of these biases is the tendency to be overconfident about beliefs and abilities and over-optimistic about assessments of the future. One class of experiments illustrating this syndrome consists of asking a large group of participants about their competence as automobile drivers in relation to the average driver in the group or to everyone who drives a car. Driving an automobile is clearly a risky activity where skill plays an important role. Answers to this question easily reveal whether people have a realistic conception of their own skill in relationship to others. In the case of college students, 80 to 90% of respondents invariably say that they are more skillful, safer drivers than others in the class. As in Lake Wobegon, almost, all the students consider themselves above average. In another experiment involving students, respondents were asked about likely future outcomes for themselves and their roommates. They typically had very rosy views about their own futures, which they imagined to include successful careers, happy marriages, and good health. When asked to speculate about their roommates' futures, however, their responses were far more realistic. The roommates were believed to be far more likely to become alcoholics, suffer illnesses, get divorced, and experience a variety of other unfavorable outcomes. These kinds of experiments have been repeated many times and in several different contexts. For example, in the business management bestseller In Search of Excellence, Peters and Waterman report that a random sample of male adults were asked to rank themselves in terms of their ability to get along with others. 100% of the respondents ranked themselves in the top half of the population. 25% believed that they were in the top 1% of the population. Even in judging athletic ability, an area where self-deception would seem more difficult, at least 60% of the male respondents ranked themselves in the top quartile. Even the klutziest deluded themselves about their athletic ability. Only 6% of male respondents believed that their athleticism was below average. Daniel Kahneman has argued that this tendency to overconfidence is particularly strong among investors. More than most other groups, investors tend to exaggerate their own skill and deny the role of chance. They overestimate their own knowledge, underestimate the risks involved, and exaggerate their ability to control events. Kahneman's tests show how well investors' probability judgments are calibrated by asking experimental subjects for confidence intervals. He asks a question such as the following. What is your best estimate of the value of the Dow Jones 1 month from today? Next, pick a high value such that you are 99% sure, but not absolutely sure, that the Dow Jones a month from today will be lower than that value. Now pick a low value such that you are 99% sure, but no more, that the Dow Jones a month from today will be higher than that value. If the instructions are carried out properly, the probability that the Dow will be higher, lower, than your high-low estimate should be only 1%. In other words, the investor should be 98% confident that the Dow will be within the given range. Similar experiments have been carried out on estimates for interest rates, the rate of inflation, individual stock prices, and the like. In fact, few investors are able to set accurate confidence intervals. Correct intervals would lead to actual outcomes being outside the predicted range only 2% of the time. Actual surprises do occur close to 20% of the time. This is what psychologists mean by overconfidence. If an investor tells you he is 99% sure, he would be better off assuming that he was only 80% sure. Such precision implies that people tend to put larger stakes on their predictions than are justified, and men typically display far more overconfidence than women, especially about their prowess in money matters. What should we conclude from these studies? It is clear that people set far too precise confidence intervals for their predictions. They exaggerate their skills and tend to have a far too optimistic view of the future. These biases manifest themselves in various ways in the stock market. First and foremost, many individual investors are mistakenly convinced that they can beat the market. As a result, they speculate more than they should and trade too much. Two behavioral economists, Terence O'Dean and Brad Barber, examined the individual accounts at a large discount broker over a substantial period of time. They found that the more individual investors traded, the worse they did. And male investors traded much more than women, with correspondingly poorer results. This illusion of financial skill may well stem from another psychological finding called hindsight bias. Such errors are sustained by having a selective memory of success. You remember your successful investments, and in hindsight, it is easy to convince yourself that you knew Google was going to quintuple right after its initial public offering. People are prone to attribute any good outcome to their own abilities. They tend to rationalize bad outcomes as resulting from unusual external events. History does not move us as much as a couple of anecdotes of success. Hindsight promotes overconfidence and fosters the illusion that the world is far more predictable than it really is. The people who sell worthless financial advice may even believe that it is good advice. Steve Forbes, the longtime publisher of Forbes magazine, liked to quote the advice he received at his grandfather's knee. It's far more profitable to sell advice than to take it. Many behavioralists believe that overconfidence in the ability to predict the future growth of companies leads to a general tendency for so-called growth stocks to be overvalued. If the exciting new computer technology, medical device, or retail outlet catches the public fancy, investors will usually extrapolate success and project high growth rates for the companies involved and hold such beliefs with far more confidence than is justified. The high growth forecasts lead to higher valuations for growth stocks. But the rosy forecasts are often not realized. The earnings may fall, and so may the price earnings multiples of the shares, which will lead to poor investment results. Over-optimism in forecasting the growth for exciting companies could then be one explanation for the tendency of growth stocks to underperform value stocks. Biased judgments. I meet investors every day who are convinced that they can control their investment results. This is especially true of chartists who are confident that they can define the future by looking at past prices. Larry Swedrow, in his Rational Investing in Irrational Times, provides a wonderful illustration of how hot streaks occur with much greater frequency than people believe. Each year, a statistics professor begins her class by asking each student to write down the sequential outcome of a series of 100 imaginary coin tosses. One student, however, is chosen to flip a real coin and chart the outcome. The professor then leaves the room and returns in 15 minutes with the outcomes waiting for her on her desk. She tells the class that she will identify the one real coin toss out of the 30 submitted with just one guess. With great persistence, she amazes the class by getting it correct. How does she perform this seemingly magical act? She knows that the report with the longest consecutive streak of H, heads, or T, tails, is highly likely to be the result of the real flip. The reason is that when presented with a question like which of the following sequences is more likely to occur, H, 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 T, 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 or H, T, H, T, H, T, H, T, H, T. Despite the fact that statistics show that both sequences are equally likely to occur, the majority of people select the latter, more random outcome. They thus tend to write imaginary sequences that look much more like HHTTHTHTTT than HHHTTTHHHH. Aside from the long-term positive direction of the stock market, streaks of excessively high stock returns do not persist. They are typically followed by lower future returns. There is reversion to the mean. Similarly, the laws of financial gravity also operate in reverse. At least for the stock market as a whole, what goes down eventually comes back up. Yet each era's conventional wisdom typically assumes that unusually good markets will get better, and unusually bad markets will get worse. Psychologists have long identified a tendency for individuals to be fooled by the illusion that they have some control over situations where, in fact, none exists. In one study, subjects were seated in front of a computer screen divided by a horizontal line with a ball fluctuating randomly between two halves. The people were given a device to press to move the ball upward, but they were warned that random shocks would also influence the ball so that they did not have complete control. Subjects were then asked to play a game with the object of keeping the ball in the upper half of the screen as long as possible. In one set of experiments, the device was not even attached, so the players had absolutely no control over the movements of the ball. Nevertheless, when subjects were questioned after a period of playing the game, they were convinced that they had a good deal of control over the movement of the ball. The only subjects not under such an illusion turned out to be those who had been clinically diagnosed with severe depression. In another experiment, an office lottery was conducted with two identical sets of baseball cards. One set was placed in a bin from which one card was to be selected by chance. The other set was distributed to the participants. Half the participants were given a choice of which card to take, while the other half were simply given a card. Participants were told that the winner would be the person holding the card that matched the one that would be selected by chance from the bin. The individuals were then told that while all the cards had been distributed, a new player wanted to buy a card. Participants were faced with a choice: sell their cards at some negotiated price, or hold on to them and hope to win. Obviously, each card had the same probability of winning. Nevertheless, the prices at which players were willing to sell their cards were systematically higher for those who chose their cards than for the group who had simply been given a card. Insights such as this led to the decision to let state lottery buyers pick their own numbers, even though luck alone determines lottery winners. It is this illusion of control that can lead investors to see trends that do not exist, or to believe that they can spot a stock price pattern that will predict future prices. In fact, despite considerable efforts to tease some form of predictability out of stock price data, the development of stock prices from period to period is very close to a random walk, where price changes in the future are essentially unrelated to changes in the past. Biases and judgments are compounded, get ready for some additional jargon, by the tendency of people mistakenly to use similarity or representativeness as a proxy for sound probabilistic thinking. A famous Kahneman and Tversky experiment best illustrates this heuristic. Subjects are shown the following description of Linda. Linda is 31 years old, single, outspoken, and very bright. She majored in philosophy. As a student, she was deeply concerned with issues of discrimination and social justice, and also participated in anti-nuclear demonstrations. Subjects were then asked to rate the relative likelihood that 8 different statements about Linda were true. 2 of the statements on the list were, "Linda is a bank teller," and "Linda is a bank teller and is active in the feminist movement." Over 85% of subjects judged it more likely that Linda was both a bank teller and a feminist than that she was a bank teller. But this answer is a violation of a fundamental axiom of probability theory, the conjunction rule, the probability that somebody belongs to both category A and category B is less than or equal to the probability that she belongs to category A alone. Obviously, few respondents had learned much probability theory. The description of Linda made her seem like a feminist, so being a bank teller and a feminist seems a more natural description, and thus more representative of Linda than simply being a bank teller. This experiment has been replicated many times with naive and sophisticated subjects, including those who had backgrounds in probability but who had not studied all its nuances. Kahneman and Tversky came up with the term representative heuristic to describe this finding. Its application leads to a number of other biases in judgment, for example, the underuse of base rate probabilities. One cardinal rule of probability, Bayes' law, tells us that our assessment of the likelihood that someone belongs to a particular group should combine representativeness with base rates, the percentage of the population falling into various groups. In everyday English, this means that if we see somebody who looks like a criminal, seems to represent our idea of a criminal type, our assessment of the probability that he is a criminal also requires knowledge about base rates, that is, the percentage of people who are criminals. But in experiment after experiment, subjects have been shown to underuse the knowledge of base rates when making predictions. Arcane as this all may seem, the representativeness heuristic is likely to account for a number of investing mistakes such as chasing hot funds or excessive extrapolation from recent evidence. Herding. In general, research shows that groups tend to make better decisions than individuals. If more information is shared, and if differing points of view are considered, informed discussion of the group improves the decision-making process. The wisdom of crowd behavior is perhaps best illustrated in the economy as a whole by the free market price system. A variety of individual decisions by consumers and producers leads the economy to produce the goods and services that people want to buy. Responding to the forces of demand and supply, the price system